Hi, everyone, and welcome to the CompuSchmooze podcast. This is episode 20 for August 6th, 2007. I'm Steve Lubetkin, host of these podcasts. I write the CompuSchmooze technology column that appears every month in the Jewish Community Voice of Southern New Jersey on the web at jewishcommunityvoice.org. This podcast is a supplement to that column and gives us a chance to bring you the interviews that we conduct when we're writing the newspaper column. Stay tuned. In this edition of the CompuSchmooze podcast, we've got some interviews we recorded during Blog Philadelphia, the unconference on the social media that took place last month in Philadelphia. We also have interviews with technology newsmakers talking about some new products. We talked to the product managers for Dragon Naturally Speaking, a voice transcription software program that takes your spoken words and turns it into text on the computer. We also spoke with a representative from OtterBox, a line of rugged products that protect handheld computers and cellular phones. And we'll also talk to the creator of the Collectors.com series of programs for cataloging your books, records, CDs, DVDs, and digital music files. And finally, we have a few minutes with Mary Madden, a researcher for the Pew Internet Project, about how teenagers are using social media. All this and more in the CompuSchmooze podcast. Thanks for joining us. We'll have more after this.
You don't want to miss PodCamp Philly, coming this September. A free unconference for both the pod curious and the pod enthusiast. Space is limited, so register now at podcampphilly.pbwiki.com. PodCamp Philly, September 7th, 8th, and 9th at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Register at podcampphilly.pbwiki.com.
We hope you'll join us. The address again is podcampphilly.pbwiki, that's pbwiki.com. Now to today's program. It's a good segue into our first segment, which is about Blog Philadelphia. Blog Philadelphia was the first of the two social media conferences taking place in Philadelphia this year. It took place in July at the Radisson Plaza Hotel, the Warwick, near Rittenhouse Square. We had an opportunity to meet a number of the people who were attending and thought we'd bring to you some of the comments that they had about the Blog Philadelphia experience. We started with Annie Heckenberger. Annie is the Director of New Media at the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation and is probably the only director of new media. And by new media, of course, we mean the social media like podcasts, blogs, and the social networking spaces like MySpace and Facebook. Probably the only person doing new media at a tourism corporation of this type. Annie was one of the principal sponsors and movers behind the Blog Philadelphia conference, and she had this to say about how the conference was going.
Philadelphia is such a vibrant market with a huge group of great web designers, social media enthusiasts, but there hadn't been anything organized in quite some time. I felt like it would be a great opportunity to pull all those people together who are talking every day on IM and emailing each other, reading each other's blogs, but don't always have the opportunity to get together in one room. As for the tourism element, GPTMC has been incorporating many different social media tools over the last couple of years, like Sound About Philly podcasts and Google mashups and text messaging. It seemed like a natural transition for an organization that's trying to make Philadelphia the connected destination, the most connected destination in the U.S., to host something like this.
Annie told us that Wireless Philadelphia initiative that's going to bring wireless to the streets of Philadelphia was going to make Philadelphia one of the unique cities in the country in terms of its availability and accessibility to internet access.
We are very excited about Philadelphia being the first city, almost what we call the pilot city in the nation. We understand that other cities are looking to us to see how to roll out their grids. We've been working with Wireless Philadelphia, and we're asking people who attend Blog Philadelphia to be part of an active pilot or focus group testing the wireless product here in Philadelphia. We provided them, or Earthlink provided them, with one-day free wireless cards. This hotel location in Center City just went wireless in the last week, so it's truly a pilot to see how it's working.
And of course, Annie said she's looking forward to PodCamp Philly, which is coming up in September.
I can't can't wait for PodCamp Philly because, and I know it's not limited to podcasts or even, you know, vlogs, vodcasts, but for me, it'll be an opportunity to be an attendee rather than an organizer, and I look forward to that. And I look forward to learning a lot. I've learned a ton just from speaking to podcasters around here today and also the other social media enthusiasts. So for me, I would do anything they asked, and really, I'm here to help the organizers get the word out about it.
Alex Hillman, one of the organizers of Blog Philadelphia, is a web designer. He works out of a firm he calls We Know HTML, and he's also the founder of a place for independent workers to congregate called IndependenceHall.org. The group holds a number of networking events and is about to sign a lease for an actual office space where people can go who are independent workers.
Independence Hall is a organization currently of creative independent professionals. These are some people are freelancers. Some of them are people that work for companies but work from home or from a cafe or a restaurant nearby and don't have an opportunity to interact with other creatives. And so what we've done is we've created a network of independent professionals and freelancers and given them an opportunity to get out of their house and start working together or even engaging each other. So through a series of events, we've grown the group to a fairly reasonable size. We're at about 20, 25 active people and a listserv that's just broken 60 or so members. The long-term goal, and I say long-term, which is only within a couple of weeks actually, was to open a physical space where these people could get out of the house every day or as often as they wanted to. It's kind of like the office share model, but with a community built as the base of it.
Alex explained that the Independence Hall concept is not precisely about people working together. It's more about working alongside each other.
Most people are not working on the same projects. They're working on their own independent projects. Occasionally, there are people that are collaborating. Actually, it's been happening more and more where someone will bring in a project and need additional complementary skills, and someone present will have those skills. It's like it's this organic forming of project teams is really incredible. So while we're doing that, that's basically kind of a proving ground to see if it works at all. And it has been working. It's working really, really well.
And overall, Alex said he was very pleased with the way that things worked out at Blog Philadelphia.
I'm ecstatic with the turnout, with the quality of all of the sessions. The session leaders did an amazing job. The participants engaging with good questions, good answers. The open grid turnout was a good experiment. I think it worked really well, and I'm excited to hone that part of the project for the next one. And I think Blog Philadelphia was incredibly successful in setting the bar for events to come. This was an event we've been leading up to with all the groups in Philadelphia that work so hard on their niche meetup or group or their little bubble. This was like an umbrella for all these little bubbles to pop and fall under one roof and engage in something pretty incredible.
And finally, Alex said there's an extraordinary amount of activity going on in the social media space and the people who work in the social media in the Philadelphia market coming up in the fall.
In the planning stages, I have set a goal of having a Bar Camp Philadelphia by the end of the year. I'm shooting for something around December. In the meantime, we've got a lot of stuff going on. Like you said, PodCamp, which I'm really excited about. There's a lot of people that I'm really excited to meet within that industry, and it's an industry that I don't spend a lot of time in. So I have a lot to learn within there, and I'm really excited about that. We also have a bunch of other monthly or so events. One of them is called Junto, that is held monthly at Punk Avenue, which is in South Philadelphia. And you can go to junto.org. It's J-U-N-T-O. And there's a little blurb about it, and it's kind of Ben Franklin, Old English style. But what you should do is put your email address in and get on a mailing list. We're not going to sell your email address, obviously, but we will send out notifications of when we're doing events and things like that. And we do those monthly. It's a combination of a mini bar camp with like 30 or 40 so people and an organized happy hour with a purpose, I think is the best way to describe it, because we've got beer and we've got food, but we bring in kind of like a keynote. At least we have a keynote topic. We may not have a keynote person, we have a keynote topic. And somebody, kind of like the discussions that went on the last 2 days, where we will present a topic and someone will lead it, but the group really gets to decide where it goes.
We talked to Jill Ivey. Jill is a blogger. She's the editor of the Philliest blog. That's Philliyst philadelphiaevent.com. Joel was live blogging at the Blog Philadelphia event, and she explained to us what that meant.
For affiliates, what I've done, the live blog is a post on the blog that's timestamped at the latest point in the day of our publishing calendar so that it always stays at the top of the page. And it's constantly updating. Anytime I learn something really cool that I think I should share with our readers, or if I just make a random observation, like I noticed that Alex Hillman has a binary code tattoo, and I thought that was really cool, so I blogged about that. And it's just constantly refreshing every 10, 15 minutes. And I'm doing it so that our readers who have day jobs and couldn't be here, or our staff who have day jobs and couldn't be here, could see what was going on.
And despite the efforts at live blogging, Jill says she wasn't getting a whole lot of direct feedback from her readers.
I have not gotten a lot of direct feedback from the readership, but we've had a lot of people linking to the site, saying, you know, if you weren't at the conference, check out Philly's coverage.
Jill said she found the conference very helpful.
I just think this is fantastically helpful to figure out where blogs kind of belong in the world of social media, in the world of marketing, figuring out how to get readership, new technologies, learning about all of these new things that I didn't know about. I'm a writer. I'm not a web person per se. So it's been really neat for me to learn about these things that I didn't know about previously.
And finally, she left the door open for those of us who are podcasters more than we're bloggers, and said that Philias.com is looking for somebody who could be a podcaster.
If we were to get somebody on the staff who knows podcasting capabilities, I think that's certainly a technology we'd love to tap into.
The mainstream media were also well represented at Blog Philadelphia. KYW News Radio had Mike DiNardo, one of their street reporters, on scene reporting about the conference. And the Philadelphia Inquirer had its deputy managing editor, Carl Lavin, who is in charge of their digital media, observing and trying to figure out what to do with the digital media.
We want to keep learning, and we're dependent on our community, the wisdom of the crowd. We certainly don't think that we know everything about this. We have a lot to learn, and the people here are going to be very helpful in my continuing education and my ability to educate our entire newsroom.
Carl said that the Philadelphia Inquirer was trying to figure out a way to integrate blogging even better than they already have in the Philly.com website that is the home for the Inquirer and its sister newspaper, the Daily News.
We're exploring how to use Facebook, for example, to connect with audiences. We're sponsoring a LinkedIn meetup next week in our building. We're looking for all sorts of ways that we can use social media to bring our audiences, the people who care about our work, together with the work that we do.
And Carl said that one of the approaches the Inquirer is taking is to try and build a new kind of blog rather than focusing on individual voices.
We're very interested in expanding our use of blogs. We are building blogs around not just an individual, although those work very successfully in some cases. For example, Inga Saffron on architecture and city planning is one very successful blog. But one that we're going to be relaunching soon is on City Hall, politics and government. We did it pretty successfully through the mayoral campaign, the primary campaign. The general election campaign's not quite the dynamic of the primary, but it gives us a chance to take what we had, we called Maripalooza, and relaunch that as Heart of the Hall. So to do staff blogs around areas of common interest.
And just one final interview from Blog Philadelphia, and that's with Lisa Marshall, one of my co-organizers for the PodCamp Philly that you've been hearing so much about. And Lisa talked about how Blog Philadelphia was giving her ideas for the programs that you'll see at PodCamp Philly.
Blog Philadelphia is a great start for new media and social media on conferences in Philadelphia. It's getting the buzz. There's a lot of people here very interested in corporate blogging, very interested in personal blogging, and it's giving me an idea of some of the sessions that we might have.
And now let's turn to one of our other topics for today's program. The OtterBox company, Otter Products it's called, on the web at Otter, OtterBox.com, is a company that makes ruggedized protection for handheld devices. We had the opportunity to play around for a couple of weeks with the OtterBox for the Trio 650, and it is a very hard-shelled plastic case. You put your Trio or other pocket device inside the case and you snap it closed and it protects that device. It's waterproof, it's shockproof, it can protect it from all kinds of dust and damage from the weather and the elements, and it's a very, very useful tool if you're going to be out and about on a rugged vacation or in wild country or in hazardous territory. As you'll hear in this interview we conducted with Kristen Gallagher, who's the public relations representative for Otter Products. Kristen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me this morning.
It's pretty sturdy.
Yeah, it's definitely rugged, so you can take your Trio places that you couldn't take them before, so it's definitely the Hummer of cases for sure. Well, OtterBox started in 1996, and we started with just our basic OtterBox line, and those are available in a variety of sizes, and you can store, you know, pretty much any valuable or technology device in there, you know, things like your digital camera, your wallet, your car keys, stuff like that. So it started out with that line and slowly just kind of morphed into protecting technology. The latest cases for things like Trios and Blackberries actually allow user interaction right through the case. That was something that customers had requested, that not only did they want a protective case, but they still wanted to be able to access their keypads and their cameras and their PDA screens and that sort of thing through the cases. So it's definitely evolved into something that has become completely user interactive while still providing that high level of protection from things like water, dust, dirt, and drops.
Who are some of the typical users that you're seeing buying the OtterBox for the Trios and other PDAs?
You know, it's funny. There's not one particular person or group of people that are buying them. It's really all across the board. People that are in construction, engineering industries, delivery industries, even the medical industries using them, because they're actually able to completely disinfect the device. So they can bring it into surgeries and record notes or take pictures or whatever right through the case. And so it keeps their device completely protected and completely sanitary, I guess, because they're able to disinfect it. Other industries like military or business travelers, those sorts of people are also able to use them as well, because with the military, for example, you're in really harsh environments, dust, dirt, lots and lots of sand. So those are great ways to protect your device. And then business travelers, even just the busy, crowded airports and cab rides and shuttle rides, and you're all over the place. And for business travelers especially, and I guess anyone else really using devices like this, it's definitely a way to add protection and longevity to your device while still allowing you to use it right through the case.
Now, you must have heard from some customers with some of their success stories where the case protected them from one of the things you just described. Have you got any unusual instances that people have told you about?
You know, we get stories all the time about people that are using the cases. It's pretty amazing. I actually am working on a case study right now of a guy over in Norway who works for a search and rescue, and he was driving away from a big accident that they had helped with and everything. This guy had fallen off a cliff, and he used his PDA to help map and track so that they could get back into the woods and then get back to the, you know, search and rescue vehicles to save this guy's life. And he had left his PDA device on the top of his car. Well, as he starts driving down the hill, he hears a clunk. He doesn't think anything of it and gets home to charge his device and realizes he doesn't have it. And this thing had fallen off his roof going 75 miles an hour sort of thing, and it was fine. I mean, he drove back to the scene, found it, started it up, and it worked great. So it's pretty amazing some of the stories that we hear and some of the industries that are using them. There's another case study that I was working on the other day, and this company called Overnight Express, they actually use Trio devices. Before using the OtterBox cases to protect their Trios, they were having a 10 to 15% breakage rate. So by using the OtterBox, they save around $30,000 a year by using these cases to protect their devices, because replacements and repairs definitely are not cheap. For big organizations and companies that have these devices for their employees to go through and replace or repair things that are broken or scratched or ruined on the job, it's definitely expensive. So OtterBox can help offset those costs.
Are there any future development plans that you can talk about, you know, future products or enhancements to the products?
We are actually going to be introducing a semi-rugged case line that will still offer pretty rugged protection, but at the same time, too, it'll be a little bit slimmer design. They'll be called our level two cases or semi-rugged cases.
I appreciate your taking the time to be with us on the podcast today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me.
And for those of you who are wondering whether the iPhone that they just bought can be protected with an Otter case. The good news is there is an iPhone semi-rugged case coming. It should be out in a couple of months. In the meantime, they've also announced, since the time we recorded that interview, new cases for the HP iPac models 6500 and 6900, and you can get more information at otterbox.com. Now we turn to the digital transcription technology of Dragon Naturally Speaking. Nuance, the company that took over the Dragon Naturally Speaking product a few years ago, has issued version 9, and that came out about a year ago. We spoke with Chris Stramiello, the Director of Product Management for Nuance, who leads the global product management team for productivity applications. Chris Stramiello spoke with us by phone, and here's that interview. Tell us, what is new in version 9? What have you done to make this voice-to-text product even better?
We've concentrated first and foremost on accuracy, and you have great familiarity with Dragon, I believe, and in talking to users and press such as yourself, the one thing that's always requested above all else is accuracy, and for a host of different reasons, but most directly because accuracy gives you the time savings and the efficiency that you need. And so we've driven this product all the way up to the ability to get 99% accuracy out of the box. And if you, I don't know how far back you go with Dragon, whether you've used it for many generations or not.
I've tried a few generations of it, yeah.
Yeah, but I think speech is, then you well know, speech is one of those technologies whose promise has been great for many years. The idea of being able to talk instead of typing and the time savings that that would afford, that promise has always been great, but the delivery on that promise hasn't always been to expectation. And when Nuance took over the assets of LearnOut and Housebee and really poured our energy into this product and reinvigorated the engineering, we were able to drive accuracy levels far beyond where they've ever been before. So, you know, DNS 8 was 20% better than DNS 7, and we're a little more than 20% better than DNS 8. And so when you're talking about just in two generations, our ability to reduce the word errors by 40%, we have leaped into the realm of highly usable and delivering on that promise and really achieving fantastic accuracy today. And so that's the biggest news with Dragon Naturally Speaking 9, is that it is an incredibly accurate dictation product. Perhaps you've had a chance to see us up online at nuance.com/talk, but we've got a little typing test on up there to see how fast people type and how accurately. And one of the key things that we learn, in addition to the humbling speeds that we learn we all type, mine was about 40 words per minute, is that the accuracy of that typing is pretty low as well. So when you think that today you can dictate at 160 words per minute at up to 99% accuracy out of the box, it is quite fantastic and quite an achievement in this latest generation. It's really about tuning the algorithms for what we call adaptive speech and what we call initial speech. And so the initial speech accuracy was never such that we were comfortable in eliminating that enrollment. And the engineers were able to make such leaps forward in that initial accuracy that it's now approaching the adaptive accuracy. And so it's good enough that we could take that enrollment piece out. Now, you can still enroll, and you're still going to get better results from dictation over time as Dragon learns and works towards that adaptive accuracy. But it's those leaps forward in algorithms that get you such high accuracy today and finally make us comfortable in rolling out this type of no enrollment, not to use a bad pun.
What are some of the ways that you're hearing that customers are using Dragon these days?
Well, I think the most popular way to use it is for long documents. People that are using Word documents or WordPerfect document construction. But we've got so many people using Dragon for email today. People that come in the morning and are able to blaze through, you know, 20 or 30 emails in a matter of minutes that used to take, an hour, an hour and a half before. So email's been a huge one. But, of course, we support browsing on the web. People are using Dragon for their web searches. We've got great vertical adoption in the medical and in the legal arenas. So for lawyers and for doctors, Dragon probably has higher utility than for any other group of people. And so we see huge uptake there. But people use Dragon to run the show and to create information in everything they do.
Any key features that you want to highlight other than the lack of the need to train the voice?
Well, we've got an auto transcribe folder, which is new. Basically, it's just the option to create a desktop folder and place your digital dictations from the handheld device into that folder, which would then transcribe them automatically. It's just designed to streamline the dictation work. We've got expanded support for Mozilla Firefox, which you well know is growing and dramatically in popularity. We've got brand new tutorials to help people. One of the things we heard loud and clear was, I know Dragon has more to offer than I'm using today, and so we've addressed that with some new tutorials. We've got a select and say indicator. This was one of the things people didn't know when they could talk and where they could talk. You're talking wirelessly right now, and one of the big things is support for Bluetooth headsets. That if you can unwire yourself from the computer, that again lowers a barrier to entry for customers being comfortable dictating. So I think there are a host of new things going on here, but above and beyond all else, it's that superior accuracy and that immediate gratification of no enrollment that gets you up to high performance right out of the box.
What are some of the things that you're looking at for future upgrades?
Well, I think the first thing that you can find on our website today is that we're going to support Vista. We've got a Vista update build up there today, and it's important to be able to work with Vista. But I think beyond that, having greater control over your computer, the easier ability to workflow items and to have macros and shortcuts. I think there are a host of different ways that Dragon's voice control can save you time. And then I'd be remiss if I didn't say that we are dedicated beyond any company in the world to delivering accuracy through dictation, and that will be a huge component of any future generation releases. It's a relentless pursuit of perfection, and we understand that accuracy translates to usability, and we're keeping our foot on the gas there.
One of the topics that comes up a lot in the blogosphere and among podcasters is some kind of a technology that would let people transcribe a podcast from audio into text, or to quickly search through an audio program to find keywords. Are you taking a look at that at all? Is that anything that might be on the agenda in the future?
Yeah, actually, both of those items are on the radar screen at the very least. We have a technology today called audio mining, which allows you to index audio content. But podcast transcription is an interesting topic, and one we've got a fair amount of feedback on. Whether that is something we address in the short term or the longer term, I think it's unclear. But podcast transcription and audio indexing are both on the radar screen, and with audio mining today, the capacity for just pure audio indexing is available.
Thank you very much for being with us on the podcast.
I'm glad. Thanks a lot.
And we move from the world of digital transcription to the world of inventory control. Most of us have hundreds and hundreds of books, records, CDs, DVDs, and even MP3 files that we've collected over the years. Wouldn't it be nice if we could keep track of them all? Keep track of how many we have, what categories they're in, and some information about those books. Well, there's a whole series of programs under the heading of collectors.com, and that's collectors with a Z rather than an S. It's a company out of Amsterdam that's created a series of database programs precisely for that purpose, cataloging your library of books, records, CDs, and other kinds of music or digital content. We spoke by phone with Mark-Jan Hart, who is the founder, owner, and CEO of Collectors.com, about the development of the music collector, movie collector, book collector, comic collector, game collector, MP3 collector, and, if there weren't enough already, photo collector. All of these programs also share in common the ability to use a barcode scanner called the Flick barcode scanner. And you'll hear more about that in the interview with Mark-Jan Hart.
Why don't you tell me how you got the company started and how you got into creating databases for books and music and the other stuff?
It started as a hobby project, as quite all of the software does that exists on the internet nowadays. My business partner, Alwin, he's quite a music collector, and he was in the mid-90s was looking for software to manage his CD collection. He had many hundreds of CDs, and there wasn't really a good product out there that he could use. So being a programmer, he figured, well, let's just write one myself. And that's what he did. And he put it out on the internet as shareware. This was just in a time when it was really booming and everybody was getting internet access. And that really helped us with distribution. So before that, it wouldn't really have been possible to do it in this way, because before, software was always done, you know, on CDs via retail channels. For us, we could just upload it and see what kind of feedback we got. And we did. There was a market for it. We very quickly started to get people who were trying out the software and giving us feedback, you know, about features that they were looking for, and or bugs. And we put out new versions and branched out to other products. But very quickly, we got people saying, "Well, you know, you've got this for CDs, but what about DVDs? What about books?" And so that's what we built. We really. A very close communication with our customers, so that people email us and provide suggestions, and that really helps us in providing updates and new features. What we do is really shaped by the requests we get from our customers. And in 2000, we turned this hobby project into a real company, so to speak. And we did that with the two of us, and now we're with nine people. Doing our best to make collector software.
When did you actually integrate the barcode scanning into the programs?
The barcode scanning using the Flick scanner, it was added about 2 years ago. Before that, we had barcode scanner support using QCAT. Maybe you're familiar with that. It was a very
sure.
cheap scanner, which was distributed for free by a company which is now out of business. But they sprinkled them all over the U.S., and we added that quite early on. And a few years later, we were approached by the manufacturer of the Flick scanners, asking us if we were interested in partnering with them. And we did, and that has been quite successful, because for a lot of our customers using the barcode scanner, especially a high-quality one like the Flick scanner, which has a laser scanner and an onboard memory for 500 barcodes, which is quite convenient, because you can take the scanner to your bookshelves or to your DVD pile and scan them there, and then move back to your PC, download the barcode, and download all the information about your collection from the internet. So it really minimizes the amount of typing you have to do to get your collection into the software.
Yeah, that was always the biggest challenge I faced with any kind of cataloging software, was having to take a laptop or a desktop computer to my attic where I have, you know, six or seven three-tier bookshelves of books and try to go through them manually. So the idea of the barcode scanner is a very appealing and efficient approach.
Exactly. Yeah, that's also why we were very interested when we learned about this opportunity from Microvision, the scanner manufacturer. And like you say, the ability to do it remotely, having an onboard memory, that's just so much better than the QCAT solution we had before, because that's a tethered. You're always bound to your desk. So either you have to take a laptop to your books, or you have to create them back and forth between your bookshelves and your computer to get them entered. So yeah, that is a really good solution. Mainly, of course, for people who have a sizable collection. If you have 100 books, then it's probably not worth it. But if you're looking at 500 or 1,000 or even more items, then it can save you a lot of time.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. One of the issues that people come up against with older books is books before a certain date that don't have barcodes on them. They may or may not have ISBN numbers. What are some of the workarounds that you're hearing from customers about how they're doing that, or are they just simply manually typing stuff in?
That's true. That is an issue if you have very old books. I believe the ISBN system was introduced in 1969, so if you have books from before that date, you'll have no choice but to at least enter the author and title yourself. But you can search a number of sources that are incorporated into a book collector, mainly the Library of Congress for U.S. customers, because it can be searched by author and title, so you can still retrieve information about those books based on that information. But you will not be able to use the barcode scanner.
Have you heard from any customers of any unusual or unexpected ways that they're using the programs?
What we've learned that we have... quite an interest for the product in churches and in charity organizations, because they usually have a library, and they usually also have a shoestring budget. So it turns out that even though we never considered these markets when we developed the software, for our product is quite a good fit with their needs. So we quite regularly get questions about how to best manage your Bible collection in Book Collector and the type of thing. So that's quite funny. It's something we never considered beforehand.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. It hadn't even occurred to me until you just mentioned that. But that could be an easy way for a nonprofit's library to maintain its card catalog without having to do a card catalog, which can be very labor intensive.
Correct. You can do it all manually, which takes a lot of time, or you can splash out for a full scale library system that's usually way too heavy and way too expensive for small libraries operated by volunteers, and our software works very well for that.
Any new products that employ the same technology that you have in the pipeline you want to talk about?
We are at this moment working on an upgrade for Book Collector. It's not entirely certain yet what new features will be that we are going to put into it. But a few things I can say is that it will definitely have ISBN 13 support, because that was introduced recently. And although Book Collector does, you can enter ISBN 13 into it, we are enhancing the support for it with regard to the integration with online sources, so that you can search on Amazon and other sites with the ISBN 13. And a major improvement will be multi-system access, multi-user systems, where you can place the database on a network drive, a network or a server, and you can access the same database from multiple computers. And that is a request we get very often from customers, like the ones I just mentioned, like a church, like a library, where they have a number of workstations which need to access a single database. And until now, we didn't really have a good way to manage that, and that will be an important feature that will be included in the upcoming Book Collector 5 release.
Tell me a little bit about the company.
I think it's a great place here, because we're very relaxed, and the nice thing is, because we have such small lines of communication both within the company and with our customers, everybody is really involved in what we're doing. We get immediate feedback, and if I'm talking to some customer who has a funny story or who has a problem, I can directly speak with the people who can fix it, or I can even do it myself and post a new version online. And it really keeps everybody connected and working as a team. And generally, it's a relaxed place. We have our Xbox and our Wii ready for our Friday afternoon tennis battles. We're not too uptight about things over here.
Very good. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much. All right. Bye-bye.
Well, there's news out of Canada that Canadian internet users are interested in blogs. According to Ipsos research, 34% of Canadian internet users have visited blogs. Even though two-thirds of the adults in Canada say they feel the information in blogs is a reliable way to keep up to date on new technology, one in eight feel the information is not at all reliable. So it's a mixed review, and it is even more pronounced when the subject of the blog is a corporation. When it comes to forming an opinion about a company or a corporation, only half of Canadian internet users think the information in a blog would be reliable, and the other half feel it's not very reliable. That information from Ipsos. And now we turn to a U.S.-based survey from the Pew Internet Project, which recently did a look at how teenagers are using social media like MySpace and Facebook. We talked to Mary Madden of the Pew Internet Project about the research.
We have a grant from the Pew Charitable Trust to study the use and social impact of the internet in the U.S. So we are one of seven projects housed within the Pew Research Center here in Washington, D.C., and we're a nonprofit, impartial research organization. So part of our role is to provide data and information and insights on issues and areas of research where it's otherwise difficult to find freely available impartial research.
So now you have just completed a report on social networking websites and teenagers. Tell us a little bit about how that came about and what were some of the important findings of that particular research.
Sure. This was the first release off of our latest survey of teens and parents. And so we have done three large studies thus far, one in 2000, one in 2004, and this latest one at the end of 2006. And each time we do a survey, we cover a lot of ground because it's frankly pretty expensive to get a hold of kids and their parents to talk to them about these issues. And so in the past, we have covered everything from sort of basic metrics about internet use, how often they go online, where they use the internet, to specific topics like the use of instant messaging. In our first survey was a big focus. Our second survey looked a lot at blogging, and this latest survey looked very deeply into social networking sites. And this first report is just the sort of overview teaser report. We wanted to get the basic findings, some of the basic information about the use of social networking sites out as soon as possible. And now we are in the process over the course of the next few months in writing the very detailed report that gives a lot more sort of information about teens' attitudes towards social networking sites and choices they make about the information that they post on their profiles.
You found that more than half of the teens who are online have a personal profile and are using pages like MySpace or Facebook, and that most of those are girls. Did you get any indication why it's more girls than boys doing it?
Well, it's interesting. This is actually a trend that we have seen consistently in our research on teens, that girls, and particularly older girls, are the heaviest users of communications technology. So that was the case with instant messaging. It was also the case with blogging, and again with social networking sites. Girls tend to, particularly older girls ages 15 to 17, tend to be very focused on maintaining their current social networks. And so what we see in the use of these sites is that actually a lot of the activity is focused around maintaining people, their connections to people they already know, rather than really trying to actively grow their networks. So in fact, the sort of true networking features of the sites are not really where it's at for these teens. They're really more about maintaining those current connections.
It's probably going to put the minds of some of their parents at ease a little bit when you find that one of the results that you mention in your summary report is that 83% of the kids said that they would not use a social networking site to flirt with somebody.
That's right. Flirting is not high on the list of uses that these teenagers are reporting. And, of course, it's always difficult to know, how they're defining flirting and also if they're being shy about their response there. But, regardless, it's clear that it's not a primary use of the site. And again, it's really more actions like making plans with your friends, you know, staying in touch with friends that you see a lot or even friends you don't see very often. One of the fascinating things about social networking sites is that they tend to be viewed as sort of a very chaotic space where teenagers are constantly changing their profiles, you know, changing the photos on their profiles, updating information. And it's a very sort of instantaneous form of communication. But in fact, these profiles are also offering a place of stability for teenagers at a time in their lives when they're experiencing a lot of change. They might be changing schools, they may be moving away, and this gives them a way, particularly in that crossover period between high school and college as well, for them to maintain contact with their friends.
What are some of the unexpected ways that kids are using the social networking sites? Did you find anything unusual, or is it pretty pretty standard keeping in touch with friends and other acquaintances?
Well, really, I think some of the most interesting findings relate to gender. Not only are older girls the power users of social networking, but they are, again, more likely to use them specifically for maintaining those networks, whereas boys are much more likely than girls to say that they're using the sites to meet new people and also to flirt with people. So some interesting differences there in across gender, and those really, again, play out more among older teens than they do younger teens.
One of the other things that your survey indicated, Mary, is that the most common use of social networking was to post messages to a friend's page. What did you learn from the teenagers about posting to each other's pages?
Posting messages to a friend's page or wall is, one of the most frequently cited activities. So we asked, you know, about all the different ways teens are using social networking sites. 84% of them said they're posting messages to friends' pages or walls. And that's an interesting form of sort of internal email within the network. But it's different in that those messages can be viewed by all the other friends of that person. So in some ways, it's kind of like a mini broadcasting network. You can post things like, you know, I'm going to be at the movies tonight. Does anybody want to come? But you can also post what normally would be a private conversation with someone, but then it's witnessed by the entire group. So that can create a different dynamic in terms of either breakups or arguments or jokes that are shared within a group of friends. And it really is a new way to sort of experience the collective friendship that teenagers experience, particularly in the high school years.
Now, I know my kids, when they were younger, were very much into instant messaging, and they spent quite a lot of time on Instant Messenger. Even when they were not around, they would post away messages, and people would ping the away message to find out what they were doing. How has the use of social networking kind of changed or migrated teenagers away from Instant Messenger?
Well, it's interesting because the social networking sites, some of them do incorporate sort of messaging features that almost function the same way as instant messaging, and overall, instant messaging is still more prevalent. So 68% of online teens have used instant messaging versus 55% who have used social networking. So, you know, but there are, of course, similar functions there where teens are using this as a way to maintain a persistent presence online and a sense that I'm always available if you need to get in touch with me. And even if I'm not at my computer, whether it's logged on to IM or logged into a social networking site,
I'll still be there soon enough, and I'll check on my profile or I'll check on my IM session. And so certainly we see some similar patterns with social networking sites in terms of the frequency of use. So 48% of teens who use social networking log on at least once a day or more. 26% are visiting once a day, whereas 22% say they visit several times a day. So really there's this sense of very frequent contact and interaction with the sites.
Any other findings from this survey, Mary, that you think are important or significant that our listeners might be interested in?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting overall to, you know, think about the way this fits into sort of the public discussion about teenagers and social networking sites, because it is easy to get the impression that every teen in the U.S. is on MySpace or another social networking site, and that all teens are simply oblivious to the risks of posting personal information online. But what's different about this study is that it shows that the situation is really a bit more nuanced than that. So, you know, we don't see an overwhelming majority of teens using the sites just yet. And also we see that of those that are using them, two-thirds are, you know, restricting access to their profile in some way. So it's clear that many teens are taking some steps to close the curtains on certain aspects of their online lives, whether or not that is meeting the expectations of their parents or child safety advocates is another issue, but there is some level of awareness. And so I do think that that we find that reassuring.
Does this lead you to think about any future research on teenage use of social networking or the online world? What do you have in store in the future?
Well, we will have this, we will have an omnibus report that's coming off of this survey. So this, as I mentioned, this is the first short release off of this survey, and we will have a report that's about 10 times as long in a few months, where we will be able to present findings on the different ways teens make choices about the type of information they share in their profiles. Also, some updated information on how blogging fits into this picture, how teens are, you know, interacting with content and sites like YouTube, and really this whole array of activities that allow teens to communicate through not only through text but also through content. And so that's really a big a sort of unique aspect about this generation. It's almost second nature to them to communicate not only through sharing words, the spoken word or written word, but also by sharing pictures and songs and videos. It's much more of a multimedia generation in that respect.
Okay, Mary Madden from the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Thanks for being with us on the podcast.
Pleasure. You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
That concludes our program for today. If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, please email me at steve@professionalpodcasts.com. We'd be pleased to receive your audio comments as well, so feel free to send us an MP3 file and we'll use it in a future podcast. Or call the podcast comment line at 1-206-333-1263. We produce these programs in the studios of professionalpodcasts.com in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. This is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.
This podcast is a proud member of the New Jersey Podcasters Association.
Hey, you got a problem with that?